You're listening to Solar Insiders, the fortnightly podcast that shines the light on the world's biggest energy source. Solar Insiders is presented by Giles Parkinson, the editor of Renew Economy, and Sophie Voroth, the editor of One Step Off the Grid. Solar Insiders is brought to you by Pylon, helping solar installers and retailers design high-resolution solar proposals in minutes.
Hello and welcome to this latest episode of the Solar Insiders podcast. My name is Giles Parkinson. I'm the editor of Renew Economy and the EV Focus, The Driven. And joining me as usual is the editor of One Step Off the Grid and the deputy editor of Renew Economy, Sophie Voroth. Sophie, how are things down in sunny Victoria, if that's the right expression?
Not so sunny today and a little bit cool, but you would expect that of mid to late autumn, I suppose.
Well, it's not very sunny up here either, and it is pretty cool. So if that's any consolation, we're about 2,000 kilometres further to the north. Look, a bit of a big week in energy policy this week. And we've had the federal government come out with its gas is good policy, which has upset a lot of people, I think fair to say, including us. But just a wonderful piece of timing. You've actually interviewed one of the directors of Goodbye Gas.
Yes.
So even though the federal government doesn't want us to go there, well, not for another 3 or 4 decades or so, there is a way and means for consumers to get off gas if they so wish.
Yes, and this company sort of started up understanding that it can be quite complex for the average householder, you know, who doesn't have a degree in electronics qualifications. And so, yeah, they're the way he puts it is the sort of we're there from the very start trying to help you decide what it is you want to electrify and when, and then we deal with all the tradies and the installations. And so it's a great service. And, of course, last month they joined forces with Momentum Energy on a special sort of incentive that Momentum set up to get its own customers off gas. This is a gas and electricity retailer that also wants to get off gas. So they're working with them to help Momentum's, I think, 70,000 odd customers get off gas.
It's a beautiful thing. Well, why don't we have a listen to it? It's Peter Steele, isn't it?
Peter Steele.
Peter Steele from Goodbye Gas. Let's have a listen.
Peter Steele, welcome to Solar Insiders.
Thanks, Sophie. Great to be joining you.
Now, your company, Goodbye Gas, pretty much does what it says on the tin. It helps, you know, regular people like me, householders, to get off gas, to switch to all electric appliances, to save money, to live more healthily, to do better for the environment. Can you just start by talking us through how Goodbye Gas came about and your sort of your history and what's got you to where you are now?
Yeah, for sure. Happy to provide a bit of that background. So Goodbye Gas has been around since 2022 now, but we sort of consider 2023 to be our real, first year of fully fledged operations. And it came about really through a series of conversations that were long running. So my background's predominantly been in consulting in sustainability and climate change in the built environment, and that's sort of if you go way back, I was a town planner and then became more specialised in sustainability in the built environment over time. And through that, I had some involvement in some pretty landmark and groundbreaking projects like the Commons in Brunswick, and the subsequent Nightingale model for infill housing development with a very strong focus on sustainability. And through that, met some really interesting people, one of who is Ben Russell. And Ben Russell is the founder of Goodbye Gas. He is an electrical contractor. He's a Sparky. Has had a electrical contracting business for 12 years or so. And back in sort of 2021, really started to notice a number of people spontaneously contacting him saying, I'm looking to get rid of my gas appliances. I'm looking to switch out my gas cooktop for an induction cooktop. I'm looking to switch out my gas heating for something more efficient. But finding that process difficult and not being sure where to start. And so he saw the very early signs of that demand from the market for someone to help navigate that process. Sort of in parallel, in that same time frame, I'd been working on, and even quite a bit earlier, been working on a number of new, property development projects, or even renovations of single, single residential properties, to go all electric and do that in a really efficient way. And so I'd sort of been seeing it from the new build perspective, or from the, yep, I guess the project perspective, and he was seeing it from, I guess, that consumer perspective. And so anyway, he got a few of us together who had varying perspectives. So myself, Jeremy McLeod, who's founder of Breathe Architecture and founder of the Nightingale model, and said basically Ben was keen to pull together an integrated service to help households to navigate that process of switching out their gas appliances, choosing, making really good choices around the technology that's going in to replace those gas appliances, and really importantly, actually having confidence that you've got a series of installers, because ultimately doing this for your typical property actually touches a series of trades, and so you need an electrician and a plumber that you can trust, as well as then you get into HVAC and solar specialist contractors to do the full thing. So Ben pulled a group of us together to sort of pilot a service in 2022, and on the back of that we saw that there was real value going through it with a number of households from sort of go to woe, and so we sort of broadened that group out slightly, put a bit of some investment together to launch the business properly in 2023, and we've been running since then.
And I imagine you've been pretty busy.
Yeah, look, we have. I mean, it's interesting how many people are out there who I think have been sitting on a desire to do this and haven't known where to start. And that's a really common comment we hear from our customers is something along the lines of, I wish I'd heard about you, I wish you'd been around 2 years earlier. I wish I'd heard about you sooner, because I've either been wanting to do this and not knowing where to start, or I've been banging my head against a brick wall in trying to make it happen and really struggling with it. So, we sort of have been really pleased with how quickly we've been able to sort of establish a bit of a profile, but most importantly, a really great sort of sense of trust in our customers, because we think at the end of it, that's sort of at the heart of what we're trying to do is to be a trusted partner to households who want to go through this process but are finding it difficult.
Absolutely. And so where do you start? I mean, is there an easy start across the board, or is it very much a case-by-case scenario?
I mean, I think the starting point is consistent for everyone. It's really understanding the nature of your home and its circumstances and I guess for that household, their priorities. So everyone is, quite unique in the sense that they might have a certain number of gas appliances they want to switch out. They may have solar already, or they may not, and they want to add that in as well. But then other things start to play into their decision-making process. Are they actually thinking about renovating the kitchen anyway? Are they thinking about moving to a different property in 5 years and so want to be considerate of how much they're investing right now in things that they may not sort of see the full, service life out of in that property? And then, just the realities that we all deal with, how much have they got to spend that's available today? Do they want to stage the implementation, or do they want to just get it all done on day one? And so, our process, whether it's via, so we sort of offer two ways of engaging with customers. It's either via a virtual assessment, which is essentially a video call, or an in-person assessment on site. But both of them gather all the sort of, hard data points that we need around what their current appliances are, what's the distance to the switchboard, is there space in the switchboard for the additional items they're installing, through to the softer side of things where, what's their sort of particular circumstances. Are they most concerned about the health impacts of using gas in the home. So actually the cooktop and if there are any sort of unflued heating systems, you know, are those the first things they want to address? Or are they thinking more of it from a payback perspective financially? Or do they want best bang for buck from a carbon perspective? It's always different. But we sort of try to gather that data up front and then help to sort of prioritise based on that.
From there. And so the pieces of the puzzle we're talking for most households, you've got your heating and cooling, you've got your cooking, you have hot water, and I guess then maybe electric vehicle, or you might have that. Is there one which is a particular, you know, cost-wise and logistics-wise, a particular no-brainer that you sort of think most households by now should be definitely going for? I mean, is it the aircon?
Look, it's interesting. the first that comes to mind for me, just because of the fact that it is almost ubiquitous, that there's basically a really good financial case to do it, is actually the hot water system. Uh-huh. So I think people, because it's, you know, this sort of thing that sits, you know, attached to the wall outside, you don't really see it, you don't really think about it, you just turn the tap on and hot water comes out. I think a lot of people don't really think of it as a major energy consumer in the home, but hot water does make up a really significant proportion of energy use in the home. And so that plus the fact that there are now really great, particularly in Victoria where we are currently operating, there's really great incentives on the table to switch out gas hot water systems for heat pump, efficient heat pump systems. So you've got two programs essentially that you can draw on at a state level, and then there's also STCs at a federal level. So there's the Victorian energy upgrades.
Victoria here. Yep.
Yeah, that's right. So there's these things called VEECs, which are under the Victorian Energy Upgrade Program. That's essentially a certificate generating program based on the deemed carbon abatement of switching from, you know, one way of producing hot water to the other. Then there's also for households that are eligible, there's an approximately $1,000 incentive on the table from Solar Victoria for hot water heat pumps, and then you've got STCs at a federal level. So when you add all those things up, and the fact that there's now really great, I think quite cost-effective heat pump products in the market, for most households, that's the first thing that we see as being the best sort of bang for buck.
Yeah. And on the heat pumps, there's been some concern lately that, you know, with all of the interest in it, and as you say, the bang for buck and the subsidies and incentives, there's been some concern that suddenly we'll see the market flooded with sort of inferior quality products and, you know, some maybe shiesty operators, similar to what we saw, you know, in the rooftop solar industry for a while. You know, how much of a concern is that, and how much are you seeing that around?
Oh, we think it's definitely a concern. And I think the positive side is that I think that concern's being taken really seriously now by the Victorian government and, you know, agencies like Solar Victoria and the Essential Services Commission. So there's good work that's ongoing now. There's been some recent consultation that's been undertaken looking at some of the options to mitigate the risk of, bad actors coming in and essentially just trying to hoover up incentives without actually delivering a product that represents value for the household. So we definitely think it's a risk. It's not a solved problem. I think there's still that risk still exists, but we take some, you know, I guess some comfort from the fact that it's been taken seriously now. And I suppose we do have a regular conversation with our customers about the fact that, because it's confusing from a consumer perspective. If you see, you know, if you're getting slammed by Facebook ads or cold calls saying you can have a free heat pump, it's then... you know, it's confusing from a customer perspective if you then are told by someone that you see as a trusted sort of provider of a service that actually your out-of-pocket expense is probably more like $2,000 or $2,500.
Yeah.
And the nuance to that is, I guess, unpicking the fact that you're still spending the aggregate sort of incentive on the table available to you from the government, and that's actually quite a big incentive, and you can only spend it once because you can't get it again. And it's really at that point a choice about, do you want to spend that one-off rebate that's available to you on something that's going to have longevity and durability and be a you know, an efficient piece of equipment in your home, or do you want to take the risk on something that's, you know, potentially going to you know, sort of break down in a short period of time, and, you know, has dubious kind of warranty credentials and so on. But again, that's it's quite hard to navigate and to cut through that sort of that promotion of those cheap products is difficult at times.
Yes, and so what you would do is just take that away entirely. Like, you are the interface between the customer and the retailers.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, we have this conversation on a daily basis, and we do have people saying, you know, I've seen a free heat pump ad somewhere else, why aren't your heat pumps free? And so we have to, you know, part of it, I think, the obligation on the whole industry, I think, is that the industry that's trying to do the right thing is to keep on educating around that. And I think there's more that can be done there from a government perspective as well. But I think, if, you know, as with solar, we saw that, you know, you sort of first step is cut out the really, really bad actors and try to make the system not work for them. And then I think you're still left with some risk that there'll be some people on the margins. But I think if you work towards the industry sort of trying to own that education and quality message as well, then you hopefully end up in a place that's, you know, better for the consumer in the end.
Mm-hmm. And with heat pumps, with hot water heat pumps, is it like with solar and batteries? Are there accredited products and accredited retailers through the subsidy schemes that, you know, basically have to be accredited to a certain level to even access the subsidies?
Yeah, there are. Some of the limitations, and this is sort of a bit of a missing piece of the puzzle at the moment on the product side, is there's not great independent verification of the credentials of some of the products. So that's something that I know is being assessed by government agencies that ultimately run those schemes. So for example, products can sort of not necessarily as limited as we think maybe they should be in the way that they communicate the things that are probably important from a buying perspective. So coefficient of performance, essentially how efficient the heat pump is at converting electricity into heat energy, the sound or the acoustic rating of the product.
Right.
So those two key things, just to take those two as examples, though, both of them can be communicated or advertised in different ways based on kind of the preferences of the manufacturer, and there's not necessarily great independent verification of the reported performance. And so, you know, for example, you could say that you've got a very, very high coefficient of performance, so essentially it's very efficient at converting electricity into heat energy. But you read the fine print and it says this makes assumptions that the, you know, inlet water temperature is at 30 degrees and the ambient air temperature is at 35 degrees. You know, that's an extreme example, but you know, everyone's COP is going to look pretty good in those operating conditions, but they're not actually aligned with the real world, particularly in Victoria, where obviously we're dealing with, you know, lower inlet temperatures and lower ambient operating temperatures.
And are there many situations where a heat pump hot water system is just not viable? You know, say if it is in a certain climate, a certain house design, that kind of thing?
So climate-wise, there are now products that work in, you know, sub-zero temperatures, and so you do, you know, you occasionally see these great photos of heat pumps operating in, you know, Nordic countries with half a foot of snow sitting on top of them, and they're still operating. Now, obviously, the performance is affected by that, but they still operate and they still represent over the course of a year, assuming that's not, you know, the conditions, you know, all year round, that they're still going to be an efficient option in those conditions. You do have to make sure you pick the right product, because not every product has been designed for those sorts of, you know, more extreme conditions. But luckily, there's very few areas in Australia that actually, you know, represent that sort of extreme from a coal perspective. That side of things is, you know, it's an important consideration. Sorry, I'm forgetting the second part of your question, Sophie.
If he knows perhaps of a house design, like they do need a bit of space at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. And we, I mean, you know, it's sort of relatively early days for us as a business, but we have seen a couple of circumstances where it is really difficult to find an appropriate install location. But most of the time there is somewhere. So, you know, the majority of our customers are either in detached or semi-detached housing types. So, you know, basically houses, townhouses. We have done some apartments, but generally in the sort of walk-up apartment building category, not sort of large apartment buildings. And that does come down to a couple of factors, like an install location, and then you've also got some complexities around the wiring for you know, for other products like induction cooktops, where you're needing to wire back a circuit to, you know, a switchboard that might be a long way away from the apartment itself.
Rightio. Which takes me to, I was going to move on to induction cooktops, so thank you for that little segue. I think one of the big sort of questions has been that, you know, people are concerned that, you know, obviously there's the cost of replacing your old gas stove with an induction cooktop, but also, you know, am I going to have to rewire my entire house? I think a lot of people think, and there's been some sort of, I don't know whether it's a myth or not, but that people basically saying you have to move to three-phase power to have an induction cooktop and, you know, to have everything else. Is this accurate? I mean, how much of it, if you've got, say, a house like mine, which was, I mean, mine's been renovated, but you know, when we first moved in here, it was originally built in the 1940s. You know, would you be looking at a whole new sort of wiring setup?
Generally not, and I don't think we've seen that for any of our customers to date. So probably the process for us in assessing it is really looking at the I guess the nature of the construction of the house and then the distance back to the switchboard. They're the two sort of key factors for assessing the difficulty of installing the induction cooktop. So essentially there does need to be generally a new dedicated cabling run back to the switchboard from the kitchen. And that's just to support that, you know, that peak draw that an induction cooktop has when, you know, particularly if you're operating multiple burners at a really high rate. So there's certainly a spectrum of difficulty there, and, you know, basically it almost comes down to, you know, how many twists and turns do you have to go around to get that path back to the switchboard. That can involve, you know, knocking a couple of holes in plasterboard walls or finding a route that goes through the ceiling, ideally. But there's, those factors do make a big difference on how complex it is. Generally, though, I don't think there's been a single installation that's required in our operating history that's required a switch to three-phase power. I do think there's some, you know, potentially overly conservative views out there around needing to do that, and they don't really account for calculating that maximum demand, you know, in a way that represents the fact that you don't design for a peak that's never going to be realized. So, you know, you don't need to design that total you know, kind of operating profile from a maximum demand perspective of the house, assuming that you're going to run, you know, all four burners on the, you know, the highest possible setting at the same time while you're also running the clothes dryer, while you're also charging, you know, your EV out the front. If you did that, then, and you wanted to do that, then you probably do need to look at some relatively major upgrades. But no, we don't typically see that. There are some edge cases where properties have a unusually low connection at the property level, and so there may be circumstances where there's a requirement to upgrade that. But again, I don't think in the, you know, 150 odd houses that we've done so far, I don't think we've actually seen any of those require a connection upgrade.
That's very interesting to hear and good to hear, because I think it's a bit of a barrier. I mean, even if it's just a mental barrier, I think people are, you know, it has been a thing that I've seen out there a lot. The next thing I wanted to talk to you about was, last time I spoke to you was in April, and it was announced that you guys had joined forces with Momentum Energy, which is the retail arm of Hydro Tasmania, in a incentive program sort of launched by Momentum to try and get its customers off gas, which, it, you know, it's a great idea for the customers, but it's a pretty unusual thing to see a retailer doing, to say, look, we're happy for you to get off your gas and switch to all electric. Talk us through that and how that came about.
We think it's a really great sign that there's an energy retailer wanting to shift customers off gas. Because I think ultimately there's a reality that it has to happen, and retailers are they're actually in quite a unique position to help customers on that sort of journey. We engaged with Momentum Energy sort of last year at some point, and just wanted to explore what their view was on this sort of transition towards all electric homes and that's right through to thinking about ultimately where the future might lie in terms of optimization, VPPs, those sorts of different tariff structures, those sorts of things that can help customers who may have already invested in solar and batteries and so on. But obviously for us, the focus is that first step of actually degasifying the home, if you like, and yeah, removing those gas appliances and replacing them with efficient electric appliances. And so we talked about a few different ways of looking at it, but ultimately Momentum came up with what I think was a really good idea, which was to not only help their customers to find someone who they could recommend as a trusted provider of that service, but also to realize that there's a series of cost barriers along the way. There's significant investment in some cases to switch out all these appliances, and that at the end of that process, there's a little bit of a sort of last kick in the shins, which is the abolishment cost. Yes. So actually to have your gas meter removed and to disconnect from the gas network, the network will charge that customer a fee, and that's charged via their gas retailer. And so Momentum was in the position where it would be the sort of the party delivering the bad news about that to a customer wanting to abolish. They suggested this program, which is essentially to credit back the cost of that abolishment, which is now, thankfully, thanks to the AER putting a cap on it, $242, I think.
Okay.
And so essentially,
that's flat for everyone.
Yep. Yeah, it is now. Yeah. So it did used to vary quite wildly across network, which was one of the nasty surprises that people got when they went through this process, and then they would call up and request an abolishment and suddenly be hit with a $900 bill, or crazy. And there's even higher examples I've heard anecdotally. So that's a good first step, but it's still a little cost barrier at the end is not it's not necessarily the biggest cost that you're going to incur, but it's just, it all adds up, I suppose.
Absolutely.
And so Momentum, suggested that, if they're going to sort of be recommending their customers to go down this path and recommending that they work with Goodbye Gas, that they would essentially put that offer on the table, that if a customer went through and removed their last gas appliance and went all that way to being able to abolish, that they would credit back that $242 on their final gas bill, which, is, as you say, on face value, a strange thing for a retailer to do. I think it makes sense for me, though, in the context of particularly Momentum being, very focused on the transition to a 100% renewable energy system. They're already, via Hydro Tas, an enormous generator of renewable energy. And over time, I think they realise that the more customers they can help on that journey, will be hopefully customers that are electricity customers of theirs for a long time, and they're supplying them with an increasingly renewable energy pool into the broader NEM.
Absolutely, it'd be great to see more retailers do that. I know that AGL has encouraged it in some ways, which is also really great. But yeah, it'd be great to see more of them doing this. And obviously, you know, it's a it removes one part of their business model, but then on the other hand, it means that they're going to be billing for more electricity, essentially, usually, unless, yeah, you get really smart and have a solar and a battery. But yeah, it's it all makes sense for everyone, I think. Finally, I just wanted to chat to you about, you know, you've got in Victoria we've got this policy now that you can't put connect new build homes to the gas network, which is great. You know, the problem is to sort of get it out of the existing houses, which is what you're doing. So we've got the solar homes rebates in Victoria. We've got the VEU program. We've got this sort of policy messages from the government. Where are we sort of, is there any really glaringly missing pieces still? You know, are the subsidies around enough to sort of send that message to people that this is what we're doing? We're getting gas out of homes and we're electrifying and it's better cost-wise, it's better for the environment. You know, do you think there's a big gap in policy or in incentives that we need to fill?
I think there's still a gap, yes. I think as fantastic as it is to have that, you know, the line in the sand around new build, new projects requiring a planning permit, not ultimately being connected to the gas network. I think that's a good start, but I think, you know, we do have the challenge nationally that we're still connecting. My understanding of the data is that we're still connecting more homes than we're taking off to the gas network. So we're still going in the wrong direction. So to me, that says we sort of haven't got the policy settings right yet. And obviously, we can't get there overnight. But I suppose our concern, and really the reason that we started the business, is because we see this as a critical component in the broader energy transition. And in the absence of a specific target for that orderly transition of residential properties from gas, from the gas network and essentially, you know, an actual timeline for what I think ultimately makes sense is the decommissioning of the entire, gas distribution network for residential properties. I think in the absence of those sorts of signposts along the way and then a rational assessment of what levers are needed to get there, we are still a little bit operating on hopes and dreams. You know, we are definitely seeing an increase in interest from the, I guess, the household perspective, but it's talked about ad nauseum. We're in the middle of a cost of living crisis. There's even less sort of disposable income floating around for people to make investments like this at the time that we're in at the moment, and it does still represent a significant investment for a lot of households. And so the majority of our customers still do sit in that sort of, I guess what you'd term a broad early adopter cohort, where, they're really committed to doing it and they've got the financial means to do it. And I think that's a good starting place.
Already got solar and that kind of thing usually as well?
Yeah, that's right. So a lot of them already have solar and solar's a great analogy because we needed that cohort of early adopters in solar to kickstart the industry. We did rely on people, forking out $25,000 for a 1.5 kilowatt system, in the early 2000s, which happened, and it was actually really important that there were those people who were willing to do that. But the reason they did that is they committed, but there was also things like the premium feed-in tariff on the table to make that make sense to ultimately and to incentivize that. And so I think, we are still missing the right incentive mix. I don't think it's quite there yet. There's great things, being talked about, and I know just as a minor example, the VEU is going to have an induction cooktop activity before the end of this year. And so that's a great sort of starting point. But I think if you look across the sort of spectrum of socioeconomic groups, I think we've still got two things. We need the middle of the bell curve to be at the point where like with solar, it becomes sort of in air quotes a no-brainer. So I think that's the desired point we need to get to, and I think we're missing some signposts from a policy and incentive perspective to get there. But then also there's a huge social equity issue here that we can't ignore, which is at the lower, you know, the lower end of that spectrum, there are, you know, significant number of people who won't ever be able to make that investment off their own bat, and there will need to be really significant support provided for government for that cohort, because the last thing you want is a diminishing pool of customers paying for the gas network to be overrepresented by lower income households, and for them to both be, you know, over indexed in experiencing the negative financial outcome of that, but also the health outcomes of being stuck burning gas in the home. Because obviously that's a terrible outcome and just sort of compounds existing sort of, you know, challenges in that cohort. So I do think we're missing a target, and I think we're missing some incentives to actually plot a path to that target. And in terms of other broad policy levers, I mean, people talk about actually putting timelines on gas appliances no longer being appropriate for sale, because ultimately, if you're talking about a time horizon of, you know, having a target to get the majority of households off gas in 10 or 15 years, say, just as a, you know, hypothetical time frame, a lot of these products have 10 or 15 year design life. So you essentially, the longer you keep allowing them to be sold, the more you're ultimately going to see people make a poor investment decision by buying a new hot water system that might, you know, be designed to operate for 15 or 20 years, knowing that actually after 5 or 10 years, it's no longer going to be appropriate.
Yeah. So we've got a lot of work to do. But thanks to companies like yours, we are getting there, on the right path at least. And it's great to know that there's somebody there advocating for consumers and helping them make good choices, because that's really important.
Yeah, well, thank you. And I mean, I think that's a really, I think, you know, the context and the incentive mix needs to be right. I think for us, and, you know, we're sort of, again, very focused on that overall impact and helping that transition to happen. I think there's a really important message that we've taken from our work over the last couple of years, is that it's not, we do need to support consumers. We can't expect people to navigate this process independently. And if we rely too heavily on, being hopeful that they will, I think we'll see bad outcomes, and that presents all sorts of risks to the broader transition. Because, you know, there's sort of anecdotal examples of this. You know, poor quality products or poor quality outcomes from an installation perspective do really sour people's experience and start to reflect on, you know, the technology itself, which is not at a time where we need to be building trust and understanding of the value of these technologies. We have to really be aware of that risk. And so, we're one small business, and looking to grow and to partner to do that. But we actually think that there's a whole industry that needs to really build up around this rapidly to be on track to support households to make this transition. Because, you know, there's still, I think the headline number I always think of is there's 5 million households that are currently connected to gas in Australia. If we're talking about a 10-year transition, that's 500,000 a year that need to be helped on this journey. When you put that in the context of rooftop solar, I think our best ever year has been 400,000 rooftop solar systems or something like that. And so you're actually talking about, you know, a really massive uptick in industry capability to get this done well.
Yes. So we need, you know, like more electricians and more, you know, everything, really.
Yeah, we need more everything. Yep. I think that's the message.
All right. Well, at least you're out there doing it, and, you know, there's a market. So hopefully people start to see that and take up this opportunity. And, thank you for your great work, Peter. And thanks for taking the time to speak to us.
Absolute pleasure, Sophie. Thanks a lot.
And that was Peter Steele from Goodbye Gas. Yes, look, it's from the work that we've also been doing on Switched On publication and with the Switched On podcast as well, and also through One Step Off the Grid and Renew Economy, it's, or even think about the EV focus driven. I mean, it is, all these new technologies are quite confusing and potentially confusing for the average consumer. So it's good that we're getting things like this that that help us through.
It is. It's very good. And, you know, I think from what Peter was saying, retailers are in a really great position to help with this and to sort of make it part of their business strategy. Obviously, losing gas customers is one thing, but you're also gaining a lot more electricity usage, electricity customers. You're finding a way that you can set up new products and offerings that can work with consumers to make sure that they are getting the most out of their solar and other behind the meter assets. So yeah, it's a really good thing, and I think this is a really part of the, you know, landscape that people can really take up. I think Sol Griffith last year said that he sees this as a huge part of business for probably even solar retailers to start offering one-stop shops for sort of home electrification, home energy generation, storage, all of that kind of thing. It will all become part of one broader offering for households.
And as it should be, because one of the first questions for people buying electric vehicles is, well, if I've got rooftop solar, how can I ensure that I am just charging my electric vehicle with rooftop solar? And the same thing about just sort of making sure your sort of heat pump is working, it's just being powered by solar, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot to be answered. So that's a good thing. So look, my big question is, if the retailers are getting their mind around this and the customers are starting to get their mind around this, how is it that we've got a federal government, and apologies for the sort of this unannounced question, that thinks that we can't get off gas for another three decades or so? It's deeply frustrating, and it's hard to understand apart from attributing it to craven politics.
It really is. It sort of suggests that, I think, as some observers have said, that, you know, the fossil fuel industry still has a pretty vice-like grip over our policymakers, which is extremely disappointing. And, you know, really, doesn't make much sense in any way. Obviously, you know, Bowen's always been careful to say that we can not just switch off gas immediately and everything like that. But, you know, yeah, locking us in for decades of use and saying that we need to dig up more seems extraordinary.
Well, it goes against what the International Energy Agency has said. You know, it goes against the things that we've heard from Chris Bowen. You know, because we have heard that. I mean, he's done a great job as far as I can see in sort of setting up, you know, sort of heading us towards the sort of the renewables goal. But I guess it's part of the whole sort of Labour Party machine, which I think is. It's always been some sort of suspicion about whether this would actually, to what extent they would hold everything back. And I guess this is sort of, you know, proof, if anything, that we probably need to have a minority government at the next election, just so at least we've got the Greens and the Teals holding them to account. But I'm not too sure whether that's going to happen.
You wonder almost whether it's some sort of a back, you know, some kind of a effect of this whole ridiculous nuclear debate, that Labor thinks it needs to sort of come out hard on gas to sort of show it's taking a responsible, I'm not sure, you know, it feels a bit like this is kind of its answer to that, or to try and reach moderate voters, or I'm not sure. It's just really confusing, really frustrating.
Yeah. Well, look, I guess the message is that out there to the solar industry, to the people working in it, and also the consumers, keep on installing solar, because that's probably the best thing that we can all do. Build up those consumer energy resources. It offers the best protection against rising prices, and also in cutting emissions. So keep on doing that.
And I think that's sort of one of the disappointing things about this announcement today, is that there isn't any message, you know, in this gas strategy that, oh, you know, so we might have to use a bit more in the energy system, but you know, we're still phasing it out in households. That's really not, there's no message there. In fact, it's the opposite. It's that, you know, we're going to let you choose whatever you want to do in your house, which again is an odd message to be sending when, as you say, the retailers are getting it, the state governments seem to be getting it, consumers are getting it. So what's the hold up?
Good question. I think we'll leave the podcast with that open question. Invite all our listeners to sort of offer a possible solution. Anyway, Sophie, thanks very much for joining us once again. Thanks for your interview with Peter Steele. Thanks again to our sponsor, Pylon Energy. Do check out our other podcasts. Got a great interview this week on the Switched On podcast with Amory Lovins, who started working on these sort of things, you know, particularly energy efficiency half a century ago, and who's about to visit Australia. On the Energy Insiders podcast, we have a interview with the CEO of the groundbreaking hydrogen electrolyzer company, Hysata, which has just completed Australia's biggest ever Series B raising for a clean tech company. So maybe there is good news in the green hydrogen space. We shall find out. Anyway, that's it for now. Thanks again to one and all. And we'll be back again in a fortnight for another episode of Solar Insiders. Bye for now.
Solar Insiders was brought to you by Pylon. Pylon provides easy-to-use solar design software for installers and retailers with pay-as-you-go pricing, no monthly costs, and no lock-in contracts. Join Australia's top solar companies who trust Pylon to design high-resolution, CEC-ready solar proposals.